This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The Senate passed a stopgap spending bill before adjourning for Christmas. It keeps the lights on and government operating for the next couple of months, but it doesn't include money for new initiatives, including two of President Obama's signature programs, health care overhaul and financial reform. It's a sign of the budget battles to come when the new year brings a Republican Congress to Washington, D.C. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The stopgap spending bill avoids the drama of a full government shutdown. But if Republicans have not gone so far as to starve the government beast with the bill, they have at least kept it on a restricted diet. That presents a challenge for the Obama administration as it launches new government programs. Spokesman Robert Gibbs says the White House still expects to find the money to carry out its ambitious plans.
Over the course of the next several months, our budget office will work with Congress to ensure the necessary funding for critical government operations.
But the House of Representatives will have a very different idea of what's critical once Republicans are in charge. Soon-to-be Majority Leader Eric Cantor says the GOP is determined to put the brakes on the president's plans, especially when it comes to health care.
We will do everything we can to delay and defund the Obamacare bill.
That's easier said than done. But there are certainly opportunities for Republicans to hold up money for parts of the health care law, such as a new Medicare oversight panel or IRS programs to enforce the individual insurance mandate. Ethan Rome, who campaigned for the measure, is head of the group Health Care for America Now, says the battle didn't end once the president signed the bill.
There'll be a budget fight over this law, just like there'll be a budget fight over other priorities.
Another White House priority that could be hobbled for lack of funding is financial reform. Barbara Roper, who's with the Consumer Federation of America, thinks Republicans will try to use their newfound political power to sideline Wall Street regulations they don't like.
Spencer Baucus, who's going to be chairing the House Financial Services Committee, has made no secret of the fact that it's his goal to roll back some of those reforms. And one of the ways, of course, that you rein in reform is by not giving the agencies the money they need to implement the law effectively.
Roper says GOP spending moves will not affect bank regulators or the Federal Reserve's new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau because they have their own funding sources independent of Congress. But that's not true of the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Roper says those agencies will be hard-pressed to meet their new responsibilities under the law unless Congress comes up with some additional money.
Members of Congress from both parties like to point the finger at the regulatory agencies for their regulatory failures that contributed to the financial crisis. But they're not as quick to acknowledge that when they starve these agencies of funding, they are directly responsible, at least in part, for those regulatory failures.
Congressional expert Sarah Binder of the Brookings Institution says it would be unusual for Congress to cut off funding for a big initiative just 1 year after approving it. But there are plenty of smaller examples of lawmakers using the government's checkbook as a way to steer policy, cutting off funds for abortion, for example, or a military weapons system that's fallen out of favor.
The power of the purse really is quite a real power, and it's one that Congress is going to guard. Certainly Republicans are going to guard it quite judiciously.
Of course, that power is not all one-sided. Democrats will still have a small majority in the Senate next year, and President Obama will still occupy the White House. Binder says that gives the president and his allies a chance to defend their favorite programs from Republicans' budget chopping block.
The first recourse is getting Democrats to hold the line when a bill comes to the Senate. And, of course, next recourse is Obama actually wielding the veto pen to say, look, that is my line in the sand, and I'm not going to stand for these types of restrictions on how the agencies go about implementing the new law.
That showdown could come as early as March, when the stopgap spending bill runs out. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. As we look back at some of the bigger stories of 2010, the trouble in the housing market is one that's been with us from beginning to end. The housing market started the year flat on its back, and as the year draws to a close, it's not doing much better. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Home sales are still slumped, home building remains around a 50-year low, and prices are still down around 30% from their peaks. Part of the problem this year has clearly been high unemployment, but also the ongoing foreclosure crisis keeps glutting the market with unsold homes. And the government's effort to prevent foreclosures over the past year was a pretty big disappointment to many people.
I was afraid of losing my home. I was afraid of being in the street. I was afraid of my mom being in the street. I panicked, I guess.
Retiree Deborah Dahmer has lived in her home in Gloucester, Massachusetts for most of her life. Her 80-year-old mother lives downstairs. Most of the family over the years worked at the nearby Gordon's frozen fish processing plant. But back in 2008, Dahmer's husband passed away. She never actually missed a mortgage payment, but she could see that she was running out of money and would soon fall behind.
I just found that when the life insurance was gone and the medical expenses, you know, I mean, I am a diabetic. I do have issues. I just couldn't do it.
Dahmer has some guaranteed income because she's legally blind and gets disability payments. And she appears to be a perfect candidate for President Obama's foreclosure prevention plan. That plan was supposed to help 3 to 4 million Americans keep their homes. But the plan has reached only a small fraction of that. And you can see one reason why here. Dahmer's been trying to get a more affordable mortgage through the plan for a year now, working through her lender, Bank of America.
I thought a big business was supposed to know what they're doing.
Like many other homeowners, Dahmer says she's been tearing her hair out, faxing in proof of income and tax documents and other paperwork, only to have the bank lose the paperwork. For her, that's especially hard to deal with since she has to read with a magnifying glass pressed tight against her face. She's been asking call center workers for a year now, what's going on?
Well, I'm sorry, you haven't sent in the documentation. I said, yes, I have. I read her the fax number that I had sent it to, the date. She says, that isn't what we need. I says, this is what you asked for.
Dahmer says she's been getting all kinds of foreclosure-related junk mail, and she's quite scared about losing her home.
I worry about my mom. Where would my mom go? She's 80 years old. Where would I go? I'm told by my doctor to calm down because my blood pressure's skyrocketing from this. How can you help it?
After NPR contacted Bank of America, they now say that they're looking into Dahmer's case and hope to resolve it within a few weeks. But federal oversight panels have been criticizing the U.S. Treasury Department this year for not imposing better oversight of all the major banks. Many have been having these same problems, and hundreds of thousands of homeowners are falling out of this federal program.
The foreclosure modification effort has been a real mess. It's very difficult problem, but even considering that, it just hasn't gone well.
Mark Zandi is chief economist of Moody's Analytics. He thinks, though, despite all of these problems, the housing market is finally approaching a turning point.
Well, housing hits bottom in 2011. It's been a 5-year road south, but I think 2011 marks the end of that crash.
Another big issue for the housing market this year was access to credit. Interest rates have been very low by historical standards, but many people can't qualify for those low rates.
To me, this is one of the variables that we have to correct.
Brian Chappell is a mortgage consultant. He thinks the pendulum has swung too far and lenders are being too tight-fisted. One problem, he thinks, is that the government-backed entities Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been in a wrestling match with the major banks, forcing them to buy back loans that have gone bad. He says that's got the banks nervous and less willing to make new loans.
That's sort of the battle we're in right now between Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and lenders of all sizes.
Another thing on the to-do list for 2011, Congress will be debating what to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Right now, the government's using them to prop up the housing market, but all sides want to see a major reshaping of the government's role in housing. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
As we just heard, the earthquake in Haiti brought an outpouring of charitable giving this year. Americans came up with about $1.8 billion to help the victims, a philanthropic bright spot in an otherwise lackluster year. Charities say they're feeling the effects of the recession on donations, but some say that things are starting ever so slightly to turn around. NPR's Pam Fessler has more.
The Salvation Army's Red Kettle Bell Ringers were out in full force again this year, collecting spare change from holiday shoppers.
Hey, Christmas to you.
And the charitable group hopes the campaign has raised at least as much money as it did last year, a record $139 million. National spokesman Major George Hood says donations overall to the Salvation Army have been down about 8% for much of the year, and funds are sorely needed for the group's programs to help the disadvantaged.
The third year of a recession seems to us to have been the one that's hit us the hardest. And I just think the drudgery and the burden of this long economic recovery that we've been in has caused people to really stop giving.
But in recent days, Hood has started to see some positive signs, and he thinks maybe 2010 won't be so bad after all.
I noticed that retail sales are up, and from the reports that we're getting from our field units across the country, we're holding our own.
It does seem like there has been a slight turnaround in giving so far this year.
Una Osili is with the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University. She says in a recent survey, more than a third of nonprofits said donations had increased during the first 9 months of this year. It's still a minority, but a lot better than the 23% that saw an increase during the same time last year. And in another sign of optimism, almost half of the charities surveyed plan to increase their budgets in 2011.
What's also interesting, though, is that the demand for the services that nonprofits provide has increased as well. So whether nonprofits, you know, will have enough resources to meet those needs, I think, is still something that we have to look at going forward.
And that's why many charities were so busy this year looking for new ways to raise money. Many were inspired by the hugely successful campaign of the American Red Cross to raise funds for Haiti quickly using mobile phone text messaging. That campaign drew more than $32 million in mostly $10 donations, to the surprise of almost everyone. Major Hood says the Salvation Army now allows donors to text contributions to the Red Kettle campaign on their mobile phones. There's also a virtual Red Kettle, where supporters who might not want to deal with the cold and rain can do their bell ringing online.
We've pretty much gone digital, and we're being much more hip than we used to be.
That's because the Salvation Army, like most nonprofits, is trying to attract a new generation of donors. Even if it doesn't pay off right away, Hood says he's optimistic about 2011. He thinks people are in a better mood and are willing to spend more, and that the new tax cut package approved by Congress can only help. Melissa Berman, president of Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, which works with individual and corporate donors, also senses a change as the new year approaches.
Because I think it looks like the economy is on an upswing that people have faith in. The persistent problem is going to continue to be unemployment.
But even that, she thinks, could inspire those who do have jobs to give more to charity next year so they can help those around them who are still in need. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. This time of year, mail trucks are stuffed with packages, restaurants are busy preparing special foods, toy stores are packed with shoppers. Operations like those require temp workers for the holidays. More than 15 million Americans are still unemployed, so companies have little trouble finding temps. In fact, since the economic downturn, hiring temps has become more common year-round. Today, we have three stories about temp workers who are helping to make our holidays brighter. First, NPR's Wendy Kaufman set out to find those real-life elves who ship presents.
Brennan Sanderson, clad in a T-shirt and baseball cap, has the rhythms of his job down perfectly. He's one of more than 100 temporary workers at an Amazon.com distribution center in suburban Seattle.
We do a lot of packages a day. We do a few hours at a time, you know, sitting here at a station and just kind of keep the flow going. As the pickers pick, we pack. And as we pack, the shippers ship, and then the process just continues on.
Right now, he's at a packing station, grabbing items out of bins and readying them for shipping.
And these are single orders, so these are single units that go in a box.
So that's a Wii you've got there.
It is. Any item that goes in the package, we use bubbles to secure them.
He gives the box a quick shake to make sure it's packed tightly. Sanderson, who's 23, used to work at an office furniture company. But business was slow, and after 2.5 years there, he was let go. He collected unemployment benefits for several months, and then a friend suggested he get a job with the online retailing giant. He gets $11.10 an hour. The work is fast-paced and often repetitive, but he likes it. He's especially fond of his coworkers and their fun-loving attitude.
A song comes on, all of a sudden, you know, just four people start singing it, you know, different parts of the warehouse. You can just hear them singing.
Favorite song?
I don't know the name of the song, but I know at the beginning of it, you can always hear it come on the radio because they're like, hey, hey, hey.
Employees here have packaging and shipping targets and quotas they're expected to meet, and the pressure, especially in the shipping department, can be pretty intense. But Jayren Hamoffer, another temporary worker, says she doesn't mind.
It's fun, you know, especially when there's a time limit for us to get out the packages on time, and there's actually two people on the line and you're like competing with each other.
The competition is about more than just packages. She and many others are essentially vying for permanent positions here.
Oh yes, I really like the people here. I like the place. They have good benefits, good pay. I'm just hoping for the best.
Amazon is expected to make some of those offers early next year. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
And I'm Craig Lamolt here in Torrington, Connecticut, where they're getting ready for another Christmas tradition, dinner. I'm at Nodine Smokehouse, where they're smoking hams, bacon, duck, venison, beef, jerky, basically anything you can smoke. And they're so busy shipping out orders that they've hired a few temporary workers.
This is definitely a godsend.
That's Mickey Fedor, who's packing smoked hams into boxes to ship them out in time for the holidays. He used to work full-time for the small company, but now he comes in just to help with the holiday rush. The rest of the year, he's a farmer.
This past year, I had 55 varieties of tomatoes and 30-some varieties of peppers.
Fedor's 58 years old, and he looks so much like Santa Claus that he says sometimes kids come up to him and say, "Hi, Santa." But this is a food processing facility, so there's one big difference.
We're wearing hair nets, and because I've got a beard as large as it is, I've got a beard net on also.
Also, he's not really all that jolly.
Bah humbug.
That's because of the hectic pace filling orders at Nodine's. The company is known nationally for its smoked meats, and they do about $4 million in sales annually. And about a quarter of that is just during the holiday season.
It's been so long that I've been doing this that I'm burned out on the holidays.
Do we have any S4s anywhere, Mickey? You got them all made up. Oh, great.
That's Jennifer Butterworth looking for boxes to pack more hams. She's also a temporary worker here. She was laid off from her last job as a paralegal in the fall.
I'm friends with somebody who works here, and I asked if they were looking for any help over the holidays.
As she packs boxes of frozen smoked hams to ship all over the country, she puts in cooking instructions and personal notes that say things like, "Merry Christmas, love Grandma."
You know, while food is something that goes very quickly, there's a lot of people that really don't need a lot of extra stuff that they can't use. Food's a perfect gift. Everybody loves food.
Although she was hired just to help out during the holiday rush, her manager says he likes her, and they're hoping to keep her on permanently.
I'm going to leave it in God's hands and see what happens.
If the economy were to grow strong enough for the company to hire her, Butterworth would get her own Christmas miracle. For NPR News, I'm Craig Lamolt in Torrington, Connecticut.
I'm Wade Goodwin in Dallas. It's 2:30 in the afternoon, and North Park Mall is an insane asylum. Try to get between Dallas and shopping, you're a dead man walking. There are the usual Christmas mall events, performances by local choirs and musical groups, etc. But by far the biggest draw at North Park is the Lionel Train exhibition. Twenty-four trains move in an intricate dance over 1,600 feet of track. They pass by the Lincoln Memorial, the White House decked out in Christmas snow, there's New York City, the Grand Canyon, and a talking Big Tex at the State Fair. The trains are great, but it's the beautiful sets, the incredible modeling that wows everyone. 80,000 people will see this exhibit over the holidays, but this year there's something different. For the first time, there's a pop-up Lionel store at the end of the exhibition.
All aboard! This is the Polar Express!
Lionel could not ask for a better display of locomotive fantasy. Wade Hulsey is the temporary manager of this pop-up. Hulsey and his wife operated a family business until she was involved in a bad car accident. So this job, 2 months at $12 an hour plus commission.
For me, it is a chance to work during the holiday that I wouldn't have had. Really meets a need for our family and keeps us in our home right now.
Hulsey was hired by Kevin Husketh.
We hire a lot of high school and early 20s, and we also try to hire a lot of seasoned employees.
If Wade Hulsey is a face of this new economy, so is Kevin Husketh. They own their own apparel store. Now they make enough money running 10 pop-up stores with 120 temporary employees to sustain them through the entire year. They're not getting rich, but it's not a bad life.
Try to spend time with the kids, and my wife is a vacation hound. She loves to go vacationing.
6-year-old Connor Barzak just finished going through the exhibit, and his eyes are shining so brightly you could navigate by them. He doesn't want a long train.
The Polar Express and the car of it and the steam locomotive, these three right here.
The Polar Express plus a beautiful steam locomotive. Plenty of power for steep grades. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.